Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you'll hear in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. We are recording this on Thursday, December 18th, 2025. And before we start today's show, an evergreen reminder that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. And now, let's get on with the show. This is the AI may take our jobs, but it'll never take our freedom to speculate about its effects on the economy. I'm Cardiff Garcia of the Economic Innovation Group, and I'm joined as always by co-host Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, this is the big one. This is the thing everybody's talking about right now. This is the single biggest economic trend of the year. Are you ready for this?
Let's rumble.
It's also something I should say that you've been thinking about for years. Technology, its effects on the economy, its effects on society, and also, of course, how it affects Fundrise's own approach to investing. So I think it's worth pausing just to discuss why you wanted to discuss this specific topic on this end of year episode.
So a lot of ink has been spilled on this question. So what can we bring to the table that's new or fresh? And I want to argue that the question everybody's debating now, which is AI a bubble?
Has it gone too far? Is it all going to end?
Is it going to blow up? Is it priced too high?
Everybody's going to lose their money. Sure. That is the question that, in fact, everybody's talking about. Will it crash the economy if the bubble, first of all, does exist? And then if it pops, and you're saying, ask a different question.
Yeah, I'm saying that that's boring.
I'll be honest. I think it's pretty interesting because it's so full of tension. We're constantly on edge looking for the next indicator that says, yes, it's a bubble or no, this is actually a thing. But I suspect that you're bored of it just because there has been so much chatter about it. This has been month after month after month of people asking and trying to answer that very same question.
And I want to argue that it doesn't matter in the long run. Take the internet. The internet had a bubble in the late 90s. And it doesn't matter now. What mattered was the impact of the internet decades later, how it changed business and the economy and politics. And so I feel what I'd like to do now and generally is move past the question of, is it a bubble, and say, forget if it's a bubble, what happens after the AI gets built out? Because I think that there's some basic things that are pretty obvious once you play it out, and then some things we can debate. And I'm interested to see if we end up on different sides of some of these questions. But I think that talking about if AI is a bubble is like talking about the weather. If you wait long enough, it'll change. It's a transient question. It's a question for investors and traders, but for the rest of the hundreds of millions of people who will have AI change their lives, how is it going to change the economy? I think it's going to have very clear and I think pretty obvious effects on the economy. And then the other thing I can bring to the table is that because we've been building with AI, we've rolled it out across the company, we're an early adopter, we're investing in it, I think I have a better sense of what it's going to do to the economy and to companies. And I can talk about real specific examples of that. I think that as a user or builder with AI, the idea that it's not going to be enormously impactful is just off the table for me. It's not even one of the possible concepts I consider. AI is definitely big. I think it's way bigger than the internet, not even close. So let's try to walk through first this premise. Let me just do the premise, and then you and I can play out the debate. So moving past this question of whether or not it's a bubble, which is a question of saying whether or not it's a good investment, and whether or not something's good investment is about economics. So price question, ultimately. But if you move past that question and say, okay, what is going to happen over the next 2 to 5 years, 3 to 5 years? So I think that in almost all circumstances, the US and the world is going to build out trillions of dollars of AI data centers. And I'm going to narrow it to the US because it's just too hard for me to think about the world. It's just too complicated. So put some numbers on this and then we can talk about the cost and the consequences. But by every analysis I've seen and I've talked to people who build data centers, I talked to some people who are building billions of dollars data centers, we'll build somewhere between 8 to 10 gigawatts of data centers every year for the next 5 years. We built 5 or 6 in 2025, and we'll build 8 probably in 2026. And so you're talking about 40 to 50 gigawatts of AI data centers to be built by the end of this decade. And I think that like when people are debating if it's a bubble, they're asking if that's a good investment, but they are taking it for granted that it's going to happen to some extent in the trillions. So when people hear those numbers, I don't think they really know, what does that mean? What does 50 gigawatts of AI data centers mean? It doesn't mean anything to them.
It's funny that you say it, because that's what I was going to ask you. What does that mean? That means absolutely nothing to me. I don't mean that it's meaningless. What I mean is that I don't comprehend what's being said right now. I don't have the technical expertise.
There's so much ink spilled about it, about whether or not that's a good idea, rather than, well, what does that mean if they do? Because I'm pretty sure they're going to. So let's talk about what that means. There's a few different ways to look at that. So what does that mean in terms of total cost? What does that mean in terms of the economics needed to support that? And then what does it mean in terms of total output? So let's just say 50 gigawatts is about $2 trillion over 5 years. We are spending about $400 or $500 billion a year. And so it seems very realistic. You need about $400 billion of economics to support $2 trillion of CapEx spend of AI data center. That's what you need. Hopefully you get more, but for that to make any economic sense, you spend $2 trillion, the GPUs, the chips, they depreciate really quickly. Some people say 3 years, some people say 5 years, but they depreciate quickly. So you need like a lot of economic support for that. And then out of all of this spend comes tokens, comes the AIs, the actual output that comes to your computer that actually is used are these things called tokens. And I feel like everybody knows what tokens are, but just in case, should we define
it? Don't assume that either. Yeah, please tell everybody what it means.
Because it's so funny because everybody talks about the amount of money, but then they actually say, what actually are they building? So if you think about it like as a factory, they're building these giant AI factories. Instead of producing cars or steel, they're producing tokens. So a token is how AI thinks, and humans think in terms of language, you think in maybe terms of emotions. The actual raw building block of AI that they think and produce is called a token. Typically, a token is about 4 letters. The word cat is 1 token. The word running is 2 tokens. New York City is 3 tokens. A picture of a light bulb is only 1 token. We can imagine, okay, since these AIs are these giant large language models, language is words. But they don't think in words, they think in these tokens, and tokens are how they process things and how they then produce outputs for you. I'm going to put some numbers on this. If you build 50 gigawatts of AI data centers and it costs you $2 trillion, that'll produce about 1,000 trillion tokens per day.
What comes after trillions? Is it?
It's quadrillion.
Quadrillions? Okay.
Who the hell knows what a quadrillion is?
Yeah, well, at that point, it's like saying bazillion, gajillion or something like that. Yeah, I get it.
So you're going to spend all this money to get 1,000 trillion tokens a day, or about that. There's some, a lot of assumptions inside of how efficient the models are, how efficient the chips are. And that's about 4 to 5 million tokens per adult person per day.
It's a huge number. And by the way, to put this somewhat in economic terms for people who want a little bit of context there, US GDP right now hovers around $30 trillion. So if we're talking about a build out that grows by hundreds of billions each year, you really are getting close to adding like whole percentage points of GDP growth, of economic growth each year. Because of course, what matters from year to year is not whether you hit the number from the prior year, it's how much more or less you end up spending on investment. So if you incrementally keep growing that number so that it goes from whatever you just said, I'm just spitballing here, but 500 billion to 2 trillion or something like that, you really are having a meaningful effect. You are meaningfully adding to GDP growth every year for the rest of the decade. So again, I don't want people to like pinpoint us and say, oh, you said they were going to spend exactly this amount. We don't know. This is speculative. But if we're talking about those magnitudes, we're talking about significant orders of magnitude. We're not talking about a trivial addition to the economy. So if this continues and it incrementally grows, it's a big increment. It's a big deal.
And everybody's obsessed with the input, which is trillions to spend and is it economic? And I want to talk about the output. So what do you get for spending $2 trillion? What's the output? And right now we can say we know it's tokens. So 1,000 trillion tokens a day, or let's just say 4 to 5 million tokens per person. So now then the question is, okay, well, you spend all this money to get this output. What does 5 million tokens per day per person get you? Because that's the big question. You're not going to spend trillions of dollars for something that's not valuable. And so this is the thing. I think people don't have any intuition around. Most people don't even really know what a token is, let alone what does 5 trillion tokens get you? And that's where I think my experience building and using AI at Fundrise, because we use millions and millions of tokens a day. And I can sort of say, okay, if we're producing 5 million tokens per person per day, what would that mean to the economy? What would that mean to work? What would that mean to the types of things AI could do? Because today, there aren't 5 million tokens per person today. So that, I think, is the thing that I haven't really heard anybody talk about.
The thing that comes to mind, again, probably using an economic approach to thinking through this, is you're talking about the output of all that spend. And I'm thinking also in terms of what will people pay for it? Do they want all that output? That has to be a part of the equation too. When people talk about bubbles and things like that, that's usually what they mean. But I think about it also in terms of diffusion, whether or not there's going to be a lot more places that currently are not using it start to use it. And the places that use it now may be on the periphery for marketing or to help with customer service or things like that. Are they going to start using it for more fundamental reasons? And what I'll say there is that the surveys that have been taken show that there is some room to grow there. So I'll give you one simple example because it ties directly into what you just said about the next few years. The Census Bureau conducts a survey. And in fact, our research director, a guy named Nathan Goldschlag, who's great, where I work at EIG, he used to work at Census and he played a big role in this specific survey. So he knows how to interpret it very well. And as of right now, only about 17% of total US businesses say that they use AI for any purpose. So this could be either to make goods and services or on the periphery, which suggests to me a couple of things. One is that use is still a little lower than people realize. But second, it means that there's a lot of space for expansion here, that if companies start finding better and better ways to use it, there's a lot of companies out there that can start using it. So again, this is somewhat speculative, but if you think that AI is going to keep getting better, and there's no reason to think it won't, that figure really could be a fast-moving target in the future, in the next few years. So that's what I would say in response to your comments about all this output that you're getting for it. Could people use it? I would say, yeah, a lot of people and a lot of businesses can still find the room to use it if the use cases are there.
I think most people are skeptical because they haven't seen the use firsthand in any meaningful way. They're wondering, well, is this a bubble? Because I don't see in my day-to-day life a lot of changes from AI tokens. Maybe I use ChatGPT once in a while to ask a question, or I see it in Google search, but I'm not seeing it in my day-to-day life transforming how I do work. So how do you justify the economics of this? And so I think that there's this knowledge gap. The whole thing, what is that the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. There are people flying in jets. At the same time, there are people in agricultural back hinterlands of China using oxen to plow the road. So some people will know about what's happening way before other people. And I think I'm just happen to be closer to the edge, not the edge because I'm not an AI research lab, but I know what people in our company are doing with it. And I can see exactly how it'll change people's lives.
I think it's accurate to characterize yourself and Fundrise as early movers. You might not be first movers, but you're early movers, especially in the space in which you operate. I think you've gotten to the point where you use AI inside of Fundrise and you use it yourself for fundamental reasons. I think if you were to receive that survey on Fundrise's behalf, you would be one of the people saying, yes, we use it to produce goods and services.
Yes. I want to go through, because I want to answer this question. Okay, if everybody had 5 million tokens a day, what would that mean? And I think that there's a few ways to do this sort of stylized of how to answer this question of what is the consequence of AI? And so one way to do it is this, okay, so you spend this money, you get these tokens, what can the tokens do? And I think that part of the reason why there's this disconnect is the tokens are a raw input. It's almost like a steel factory. Steel's not that useful, but steel that's turned into girders for building buildings or railroad ties or cans for food. The raw input is not as useful as the actual application. So there's this intermediate step that's happening right now, which is that you have to have built an application with AI that uses tokens as the input, and the output actually some kind of useful work. We've done that across the company. I want to share some examples and talk about how many tokens each one of these things actually uses to give you a sense of what's the economic value of 5 million tokens. Because if economic value is very high, then you start thinking, uh-oh, maybe this is actually going to have a huge impact and people are underappreciating it.
And also it would then earn the right to have itself labeled general purpose technology. The technology that doesn't just affect the immediate sector in which the technology was developed, but it essentially affects technologies inside of industries and sectors all across the economy. It changes everything. Everybody has to rethink how they produce things. And consumers end up also just altering their own habits, their consumption habits because of it. That's a general purpose technology. And if what you just said is what comes to pass, then yeah, it will definitely qualify as that. So yeah, go through one or two examples.
It's funny to me because people are debating it. I'm like, no, it's already in the past. That's like old news. I know this is happening. It's definitely, what the heck are we talking about? It's definitely general purpose technology.
This is a 2024 debate.
It's so general purpose. And I think this is like a funny thing for most normal people who are not in the tech business. They look at AI and they're both skeptical and actually afraid. And they think there's more fear of AI than any technology you've ever seen. And I think they're right to be afraid. I think that it's going to have a lot of negative and positive impacts. And I think people's instincts are not that far off when I've seen the impact in the micro sense. Let me go through some examples and I will come back to why this general purpose technology theory that you were putting out there, because I think it's the most general purpose technology. Maybe electricity is more. I think so. But AI, it automates cognitive labor. And the same way that we automated factories, the number of workers per factory has been falling for decades because you can automate making cars and making shoes. And that's what's going to happen. And that's what is literally happening today at companies around white collar work or knowledge work. So here, let me give you a few examples. So let me do customer service first, but I could do customer service, product development, real estate analysis, accounting. I could do software development. There isn't a department that hasn't been impacted. And it's really a question of the scale of impact. So let me go through some specific examples. So customer service. Fundrise gets something like 6,000 customer service tickets a month. Half of those are handled by AI. And the questions are anything from reset my password to help me understand this investment. So this is a broad set of questions people ask. So people are writing in emails or chat. And then depending on the question, it gets triaged to an AI. I want to anthropomorphize the AI. It's like a person. So what's that person cost and how many people did it replace? Because it fundamentally replaced a lot of people. So it handles half our customer service and it costs us $51,000 a year. That's how much we're spending for this AI customer service agent. It replaced 6 people and it uses about 2 million tokens a day.
Let me just pause on the replacement of people that you would need to do the same job that the AI is doing. AI costs $50,000. 6 people doing a job like that, assume, and this is just for a nice round number, 100 grand per person, a salary and compensation, that's 600,000. That's a 12-to-1 savings is essentially what just happened there, or 1/12 savings, I should say.
It's easy for people to imagine. They know that they're interacting with AI, I think, more and more. Like, you're going to see Delta Airlines and lots of different customer service become AI. And what's interesting about it is that in some ways, it's not as good as a person. In some way, it's far superior. So let's talk about how it's superior, because I think there's dimensions where people aren't thinking about it and where I think it becomes very powerful. So one is it's 24/7. So you can get that customer service all the time. If you have a flight, you miss your flight, it's midnight. Now you can get your flight changed. You can get the customer service all the time. There's no wait time, so it's way faster. In terms of how it affects the organization, I think this is, again, something that we'll repeat. Is it took away the easy work, or if you wanted to say the clear work or the work that's most routinized, the most repetitive work. And it's interesting when you think about that and extrapolate that to the whole country. On one hand, that's great because a team actually loves it. They got rid of the work that was repetitive and boring, and they kept the work that's really interesting and high value. On the other hand, I think what's left is the harder work. So it's interesting. It's nice during your day to have some easy work, some hard work. But if you're mostly stuck with the hard work, I think it's going to have an interesting, surprising effect.
It requires a different approach to the work itself. You have to marshal your energy in a different way. If you have a day where half the day is sending mindless emails or that kind of thing, and the other half is really hard thinking, you could just about pull it off if you manage your time the right way. If you have 8 to 10 hours of really hard thinking work, that's a tough day. You almost can't happen. You need to space it out a little bit because really hard work requires a different approach than the kind of routine stuff that you're describing here.
And one of the challenges with that is a lot of times really hard work, it's not 4 hours is more valuable than 2 hours. A lot of times this is something I think there's something about the brain at Fundrise when we're doing hard planning. We will do a session and be like, let's come back a week from now, because literally a week from now, we'll have the answer and we won't even know how our brain came up with it. But it's some sort of like hidden cognitive analysis happening when I'm sleeping and when I'm in the shower. So taking away a big chunk of the easy work isn't all gravy for me. This is a subtle thing, and we can come back to some of these larger meta consequences.
This is very common for creative work, especially work where you really need to figure out how to combine ideas and find new ways of doing things. Inventions, you think really hard about it, then you step away, something clicks and you come back. It's all a little bit mysterious, but it's been shown again and again to really happen. And it's especially helpful for the hard problems to have that break in between. It's just a very different approach to work than what you're describing routine work is like.
Later when we get to it, I think there's some interesting analogies that we've seen transformations like this from agricultural society to industrial society, and we're going through this transition. And the work you did being an agricultural society, farming, and the work you're doing sitting at a desk is so different. I think we're going to go through a radical transformation, but let's come to that in the end. I just want to give you more examples.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more examples, especially because you just described customer service. But of course, Fundrise is not primarily a customer service organization, even though, of course, it has a customer service component to it. Why don't you talk about the way it's used for the really nuts and bolts stuff, like investment ideas, investment decisions, real estate analysis, stuff like that?
I wanted to do things that were more common across lots of organizations. Let me come back to that one, because I think that one is, as a manager and a manager of an organization, one of the things I find is that there's two kinds of management. There's figuring out, defining the work, and then there's doing the work once you figure out what to do. And obviously, I'm on the mostly figure out what to do job, but I think that the doing the work is going to get increasingly done by AI, and the figuring out the work is going to be done by people. And people who like uncertainty will do better in this world. But anyway, so here's another one. I'm trying to give you a sense of what tokens are worth. So I skipped a piece, which is that the key to this analysis is that you need to turn raw tokens into an application. And then when you have an application, you can see the work it does, and it's far more efficient. Or even tokens without an application almost can't get the job done. But once you build the workflows and build the product, another example is cybersecurity. So we at Fundrise get attacks all the time. There's this 24/7 management of access, all these things happening, and almost think of it as like watchdogs. And you have an IT team, and the IT team does that kind of work. They also help desk. People are like, hey, my computer's broken, I can't figure out how to do it. They're like, try turning it back on and off. There's all these like work around IT. So we implemented it around, we had to build these workflows because a lot of the stuff doesn't totally exist, but we built these workflows around cybersecurity. I can get kind of technical around it, but the point is that it does a lot of analysis looking at things that are happening, attacks and things like that, and where people like somebody turns on their computer, that computer is in Argentina, should it have been Argentina or not? Did the person go on vacation? That can be done by AI rather than saying some IT professional trying to check to see that person put a notice in that they were going to be on vacation and brought their computer with them or not. There's all these things happening. That's something that's highly valuable, saves hundreds of hours a month, and it's a couple million tokens a month.
That's a good example. It's definitely something that applies everywhere else too.
Another one, everybody knows about this, but we used to have 3 copywriters at the company, and now we don't have any because AI is so good at writing copy. I can talk about product design, which again, maybe is a little bit too specific to the software industry, but when you create software product, like what should this website look like? Used to have designers and product managers, and now a person can really figure out what it needs to look like. They call it vibe coding, and use that to give to the engineers. So it's like a way to scope out what you're building. So what AI is really good at doing is doing things that require a lot of greenfield new thinking fast. So a lot of times with software development, you're trying to figure out how to attack a problem. I asked our software team and our CTO, my CTO is very earthy, like very grounded. So he used to be total skeptic of AI. He's skeptic of everything at first because that's his nature, which makes him good. And I said, if you have 2 teams or 100 software engineers, front end, back end, mobile engineers, one has AI codecs or Claude Code, one doesn't, what's the efficiency gain? And it's probably 25 to 50%. So across these boards, the pattern is, and how many tokens do you need? I'll give you one other one. So I'm trying to give you this sense of what tokens are worth for work, because tokens are cognitive work, is that a software engineer built out this project for AI to do. AI is really good at routinized projects. A lot of times you have to upgrade your software. You go from, this is not exactly right, but Microsoft Office 95 to Microsoft Office 2001. There's these changes to the front end and to the view migration. Here's one that's really interesting. Doge failed partly because it was trying to upgrade software at Social Security Administration and Medicare that was written with COBOL. you can now do that migration with AI to Java, where before it literally would have been impossible. And now if you build it out, it can literally do that migration from COBOL to Java. So you're talking about saving untold years of work. So a typical project that might have taken our team 8 hours takes them maybe 30 minutes and it costs 5 million tokens. So an advanced software engineer is probably costing you hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. It saved them 6 hours maybe, and that was 5 million tokens. And because of token caching, it cost $2.50. So the bottom line is that tokens in an application that's built to do a certain job are highly valuable. And so I would say, if you said you took every white collar worker in America, there's 100 million workers, and you said, okay, each one of them got 5 million tokens, that's easily enough tokens to do half of their work. Now, of course, you have a diffusion problem, adoption problem. That's really the problem.
Or they could double how much work they do or how much output they themselves get out in the world. It makes them more productive.
Or both. But the point is, what I've been trying to do, and this is really the punchline, is how many tokens equal to a worker, like an FTE, a full-time equivalent? And I'm saying that I think about 2 million tokens is enough to do 50% of almost anybody's job.
So with enough tokens, basically, you could replace a huge chunk of the white-collar workforce. I think that's where you're going with this.
Yes. It's not even a can. I think it's going to happen.
Or will. Or
it will happen. It's only a question of diffusion. We've been doing that since we launched and adopted AI. We haven't hired a person since. You're seeing that across the economy. No one's hiring anymore. You don't need to hire. We haven't actually had as many people let go. It's just made the existing team so much more effective. And so I think that we're the future of what companies will look like. We just need a lot less people to do a lot more work.
Yeah, there's an interesting next order effect there too, which is, let's say for a minute that the economy starts operating the way you've just described it, which is not hiring as many people as you would have hired in the absence of this technology, still getting as much or more than ever done with the same number of people. Companies become more efficient, more innovative, more productive. Take that to the next level. What that also means is that the people who continue working for Fundrise make more money. You're making more product, you're selling more product, you're more efficient. So with that more money, with that added money you're making, you will then look for things to spend it on. You'll be able to afford things that in the past you may not have been able to afford, and you'll spend it on parts of the economy that are not being affected as much by this in terms of the number of people that are employed. So this is just a basic sectoral shift, maybe accelerated, maybe rapid, but the nature of the economy could change because of it, but it doesn't mean that everybody's condemned to unemployment forever and ever.
It's a fact. It's not a hypothesis. It's already happening. You can adopt it if you have smart people who can spend a little time building out the routines with AI. It will take on work and it's going to do meaningful part of people's work, tens of percent. So that's tens of millions of people of work. So you get past this question of, is it going to affect the society? And you start saying, okay, what is the effect going to be? Is it definitely a general purpose technology? And let's talk about general purpose technology. How is it different than past general purpose technologies? Because I think it's more general because it automates cognitive labor. And other technologies in the past really didn't have all of the boxes checked. So the things that make it so wild is that it essentially, it's like capital that behaves like labor. You have a huge CapEx investment. It's highly flexible, and then it scales to nearly infinity. Another way to look at it is very fungible. So if you have tokens, tokens be used in different industries. So you can be in healthcare, or you could use a token in finance. You can use it to different companies. It'd be used to different jobs, a lawyer or an administrator. It'd be used to different tasks, a writer or coding. We've talked about it. You can use 24/7, and also it can be used in any language, so any nation. So it's super generalized. A person, you may be super competent, but you can't change industries, you can't change jobs. It's hard to change companies. There's only so many tasks you're able to do. It's very, very, very general. And I think that's something that makes it different than other technologies in the past.
The possibility that it will be doing cognitive tasks that in the past simply were not automatable. And by the way, not just routine cognitive tasks, as you were describing earlier. If it gets into the non-routine realm, if it gets beyond just fixing contracts or giving you bog standard generic prose or doing rote customer service type stuff. If it gets into the more creative space, the space that involves connecting ideas together, making decisions, really well-informed, smart decisions, then we're really talking about something that can do tasks that in the past just would have thought were kind of impossible to take over.
But I think the magic is to think of it as a co-pilot or as a pair. An AI plus a really competent person is worth 10 people. Not to think of it as purely automated. If you were a maniac and you wanted to produce 10 podcasts a week, you might be able to do that with AI. It would have been impossible before.
Wouldn't unleash that on the world.
But in software, you can write more software. You can do more customer service. There's all this analysis that's possible. The way to think about it is to think of it as how many tokens does it take to automate 10% of your job, 20% of your job, 50% of your job? And then you can get to 90% like we did with customer service. But I think that you have this rapidly diminishing returns and you don't need to get to 100% for it to be extremely effective. So just to use 50% is a fairly good number, 100 million people, 50% automated. That's 50 million AI workers or an impact of 50 million new in the United States alone. So I think I want to move to this next thing. So if you say, okay, I think that's true. I think that AI is going to be very, very much a general purpose technology. What's the economic impact? Because I think that for whatever reason, it's so obvious, and yet most people are focused on the bubble question or their job. Is it going to get rid of their job? But not, what does it mean for interest rates? What's it mean for growth? What's it mean for politics? I mean, there's some really, really obvious things that I feel like are just not talked about much.
Do you want to shift into that phase of the chat?
Do you think I convinced you that it's maybe not fully, but more than before? You know, you're already there.
Let me put it this way. With a task like this, the question is, will this technology transform the economy, not just from where it is now, but at a faster pace than prior technologies had transformed it? I think there's a very, very strong possibility that it will. This is one of those things. I have the luxury, as I've told you this before, of just being uncertain, of just waiting to see what happens. But I think it would be so silly to dismiss the possibility that just 2 or 3 years after we learned that we had the ability to essentially talk to our freaking computers and it would answer in a way that was totally unrecognizable, that this won't have some pretty impressive effects across the economy. I think there's a really good chance of that. So let me put it this way. I'm very impressed, I will say, with all the different ways that you and Fundrise use the technology. How quickly will other companies follow in your footsteps? Will they learn about all these different ways of using this technology? Will they also make similar decisions of, hey, we're producing more than ever because we can use this with the same number of people. So this is great from our standpoint. We don't need to increase the total number of people that we employ to keep doing really well. That I find very convincing. I find that terrific, frankly. And I think the more of this experimentation, the closer we'll get to learning exactly how transformative it will be. But I think it would be crazy to dismiss that possibility outright. And a lot of people still do. A lot of people essentially say that this is all just an LLM situation and that, well, yeah, but they'll always just take the aggregate of the knowledge that's already out there. I disagree with that. I think that there is the prospect for this technology to be used in some new, interesting, and quite profound ways. And I'm very excited about it, by the way. I have maybe less fear than you do that this will suddenly lead to a big, sharp reduction in the number of people employed, a call across the economy. I'm a little more optimistic there, but let's go there then.
I have a slightly different take on that. You want to be an early adopter of things that are really significant. You don't want to be late to the party. So the impact on the economy. So as you said, there are still some really big open questions. I absolutely agree. I think the biggest one is the adoption curve. How long does it take to change people? People are the bottleneck. People, organizations, governments, all these things are slow to adopt. There's an open question of how much AI progresses. It's still progressing. It's getting better. And there's a little bit of a question of, do they build 50 gigawatts, 30 gigawatts, or way too much? Because they could do too much. I'm not saying that's not possible. Okay, so you move on. This all happens to some extent. So I think before we talk about the impact, I think we got to agree on the baseline. Because I feel like people forget what the status quo is and they get lost in the theory of it. I'm going to argue that what AI is going to do is in part already what's happening. And I know you already know this, but let me just put some of the stats on here because I think people who aren't economic nerds like you and me may not track the labor share of GDP and things like that.
Hey, this is all important. This all matters. Yeah, let's give that to the audience.
Okay. So if you want to go check this, you can go look at the Federal Reserve of St. Louis has this thing called FRED, and you can go look at Google labor share of GDP or labor share of income. So labor versus capital as a share of the total amount of income or GDP of the country. And it was pretty much at around 62% from 1950 to year 2000. It was pretty stable as labor's share of the GDP until about 2000. You can say, well, maybe it was early 90s, but it really looks like technology has changed. I think it's technology. We don't know exactly what the other reasons might be, but labor's share of income has gone from about 62, 63% to about 58%. So labor has a smaller share of income and it's been trending down for the last 25 years.
Yeah, I think the leading contenders for what could be behind it are technology is one, for sure. Automation is one. The rise of globalization, possibly the China shock, things of that nature may have played a role. Simple methodological issues with it. The rise of income inequality, which appears to have actually either plateaued or possibly even reversed a little bit over the course of the last 5 or 10 years. A conversation for another time, but that could have played part of the role earlier. But of course, that gets back into what caused that. So yeah, I think technology and trade are the two big contenders for what could be explaining that.
Another stat that you can also go look at is corporate profits as a percentage share of GDP. So how much of GDP is captured by corporate profits? So it was about 5% of GDP from 1940 to year 2000. And corporate profits as a share of GDP has been rising since 2000 and has more than doubled in the last 25 years. So it went from 5% to about 11.5% this year. I think that is clearly about technology. It takes less workers. Things are capital light, more efficient, more automations, lots of things driving that. Having corporate profits be a greater share of GDP is a really interesting and I think very correlated phenomenon to their labor share of GDP.
Yeah, they're in some ways the inverse concept. Not perfectly, but something like that.
One other, just see when I talk about those trends, I think you think of those trends as linear, but actually if you could look at both of those data sets, you see that it stair-stepped. So you see that there was usually every recession, every downturn, year 2000, 2008, 2020, there's a shift. And there's a shift to a lower percentage of labor as a share of GDP or higher corporate profits. So it stair steps, even stair stepped around the early 90s. What used to happen before 2000 is there'd be a stair step down and then it would recover. So labor's share of GDP would decline because obviously people are being laid off in a recession and they would recover back up. Or corporate profits as a share of GDP would decline during a recession and then come back or actually improve as a share and come back up. But what's happened since 2000 is that after each recession, it plateaued a new low in 2000, 2008, and 2020. What I think is happening is that there's during these downturns, companies, organizations are forced to change and they adopt things like telehealth we saw during COVID. They adopt these things all at once during a recession where the technology's been there, but they really didn't have a necessity to adopt these efficiency-driving technologies.
Yeah, I should note that a similar trend is seen in manufacturing employment, where there's a shallow recovery when the economy is doing well. Then there's a massive steep collapse during a recession. And then again, a shallow recovery that never quite gets back to the prior peak. And the thinking there is exactly what you just said, which is that very often a downturn will force companies to do a rethink or a lot of companies that maybe wanted to put in place automation technologies, but didn't want to piss off their workforces, then have what you might refer to as an excuse to do exactly that, that, hey, we're in a recession. We need to let some people go. Everybody else is doing it. So there's the cover of the social proof of letting people go. So they make the changes then that perhaps they had wanted to make earlier. Because frankly, it's not easy for companies, you know, or for, I should say, individual managers, I guess, to let people go. And it can be a PR problem for the companies. Very often they want to make these changes, but the triggering effect ends up being a recession. I would add one more point because I think it is intertwined with everything you just described, which is that ever since the year 2000, the recoveries from the downturns have been quite unimpressive from a labor market standpoint, with the exception of the most recent one after COVID. So after the 2000 bubble pop, the recovery was famously known as the jobless recovery. And that only lasted until we got to the financial crisis, which was a massive catastrophic problem for the labor market. And the labor market didn't really get tight again until roughly 2018, 2019, and then bam, ran into COVID. So you're talking about multiple decades where the labor market was not tight. It was just a really bad negotiating position for workers all throughout that period. That's a very long time for that to be the case. And I think that played a role in all of the trends you're describing, certainly the decline in labor share, the gain in the corporate share, and so forth.
So because there's these episodes, episodic, or these stair steps in the way you described it, where companies and organizations make these changes because they have to, or the permission to, that's why I think it's mostly technology. It's not all technology, but it's mostly technology in the broadest sense of the term technology, because adoptions of changing in process and things like that. So you already have this baseline trend, labor share of income declining, it's corporate profits share of GDP increasing. And I think that trend not only continues because of all sorts of technology, not just AI, I think that AI virtually guarantees it continues. And then I think it accelerates that trend. And so I wanted to put some, this is a classic us doing scenario planning, but just take that trend and extrapolate it out, and then take that trend and just magnify it. And I think that it's clear to me that trend is not about to reverse. What we're talking about, automating white-collar workers, the way that we automated blue-collar workers, is a magnification of the trend. So let's just do the trend continues versus trend accelerates. So we're at 58%, or let's do corporate profits, because corporate profits means big stock market. So corporate profits are 11.5%. It basically doubled in about 25 years. So you do that again, corporate profits are 15, 16% by 2035. So you have this increase of another few percent, and same thing with labor share profits. So you have this decline, and then you say, okay, what if that actually is even more? And corporate profits go to 17, 18%, labor share of income goes to 50, 52%. I think that unless AI is somehow some kind of weird mirage, which I don't think it is because I've lived it, I think the economic impacts of AI is some band within that trend. And this is why I think when you look at the impact of AI, when you go down the list, it's only a question of magnitude. It's not a question of direction.
I would also say it is also a question of how policy responds. That's a big deal. And I'm talking primarily about how the Fed responds to the trends that emerge, and depending on the size of the shock, which in the scenario you just described is a massive new trend in the economy. I think it would accurately be characterized as a shock. Do fiscal policymakers also respond? Keeping in mind that all of the added production that we would end up getting from AI could potentially be very good, again, depending on the policy response, for the fiscal coffers. It could be very good for the maneuverability that the government has for how to respond. All of these things could be actually quite healthy. If the economy becomes way more efficient because of AI, and the Fed doesn't rush to go back to a super tight labor market because of the growth of other sectors or whatever, what you're talking about is a huge disinflationary trend, which gives policymakers a lot of room to maneuver at that point. By the way, it'll just naturally lead to, again, in the absence of something else happening, lower interest rates, because that's what happens in disinflation, which, again, more maneuverability for policymakers because this is a favorable technological shock. And I'm not talking about workers right now. I'm talking primarily about added productivity growth. How it affects workers, again, does actually depend a lot on how the economy adjusts and how policy responds. You see what I mean?
Yeah. I feel like, again, everyone's obsessed with this question of how it affects jobs, especially their job. They're missing this big picture. So let's put this question of how it affects workers aside for a minute and come back to that last. Because I think that's the most contingent. But some of these things, I think, are much less contingent, much more likely. So I think that you said it. Technology, and in particular AI, is highly disinflationary. And I believe that people are sleeping on this because everybody's obsessed with inflation, looking backwards, looking at COVID, looking at all the money printed. We're about to put trillions of dollars into an extremely deflationary technology. And I think it's going to lower CPI, especially CPI around services. So wage growth and the general things that have been driving inflation, I think, are going to get muted. And that's, I think, going to create a lot of room for policy. I think there's no question about that. And it's just a question of magnitude. And the other ones just go down the list. GDP growth, clearly very positive for growth. It's just a question of magnitude. Corporate profits, stock market, It's very good for that. It's just a question of magnitude. Before I get to unemployment, let's talk about treasury rates and fiscal debts. I think it lowers the 10-year treasury because lower inflation means lower treasury. And I think it drives more taxes back to the government because there's tons of growth. And so it's good for deficits. So I think across everything but labor, it's very, very positive.
Yeah. By the way, there is another sense in which that analogy to the 90s can be applied here, which was the 90s were also a time of rapid productivity growth. So let's say we get back to that place. And there was a moment where Alan Greenspan essentially was being pressured to raise interest rates at one point, but he could see the productivity enhancements that were being made. And he said, nope, we can leave interest rates where they are. I don't have to raise rates here. He could keep rates low and see that essentially we would not get a big boost to inflation because productivity growth was, in fact, as impressive as he had anticipated it to be. And if something like that happens again, this could affect how the Fed responds. And I would say then it would be fine for workers effectively if policy responds the right way. Okay, that you're right. That is contingent. But it's worth noting that the 90s were a time of tremendously low unemployment, even though all these productivity enhancements were being made. And even though that was a time of astonishing innovation and implementation of things that could happen again and budget surpluses. So it's all connected.
Yeah. And the response to the technology potential in the 90s was a huge investment. Everybody saw it, got excited, invested in it, and that investment ended up paying off. So that's what's happening again. And just a few other second order consequences that drive interest rates down even more. All that excess profits, all that excess returns ends up as capital abundance. And capital abundance means lower rates.
Famously back into the chase for yield, that kind of thing.
Yeah, more money means less return. It's a supply demand. So I think there's a very, for us, we also do real estate. I think there's a very positive story for real estate because rates are going to come down as a result of AI. Growth will be higher. And I think that the last question is, what does it mean for labor? What does it mean for policy? And I wanted to look at a single industry and talk about how that industry could end up succeeding with good policy or failing. Because I think it's interesting because I think a lot of people's initial response to this is a little bit of fear and dislike because they don't like the idea of having AI take a lot of their job. That's how they think this emotional response. What I think is actually there's for most people, it's very positive for them. Let me just do how it goes bad as a policy and how it goes well. And I think it's easiest to see that in the healthcare industry. So let me just do healthcare and then I want to hear your thoughts. So healthcare, there are 20 million people work in healthcare. It costs $4.5 trillion a year. And if you go look at the work, a huge part of healthcare is administrative costs. Everybody knows that documentation and the billing and the claims and nonsense is a big problem in healthcare. Of the 20 million workers, something like 5 or 6 million of them are in the administrative part of it. And only 7 million are doctors and nurses and the techs. And so there are millions of healthcare workers that do administrative work. And people find healthcare inflation infuriating and they don't like the healthcare process. So you can see a world, an absolutely clear world where AI starts to automate a lot of the billing and the doctors taking notes and the claims. And all of a sudden, doctors have more time to spend with patients and the cost of healthcare comes down. And okay, there are people in the healthcare industry who end up being displaced. I could easily imagine 10%. That's a couple million people get displaced. But for the rest of society, having the cost of healthcare and the practice of healthcare get way improved because of AI, it's a massive benefit.
I have two responses on healthcare, because I think a lot of what you said is dead on, but healthcare is a tricky one. So first, it is absolutely the case that the healthcare sector could use a ton of efficiency enhancements. There's just absolutely no question about it. They also have a problem with occupational licensing issues where nurses aren't allowed to do things that they could do because doctors want that turf for themselves, stuff like that. Efficiency enhancements are definitely a thing that could happen there, but the government's very intertwined with the healthcare sector. There are unbelievably arcane rules that still govern what can be done there. So even if the technology to help healthcare is invented, exists already, et cetera, what you need to sort there is the human-made barriers, the laws, the rules, the regulations, and so forth. And the healthcare sector is a tough one to get that right, even though I think the technology still will break through in at least some places. Second, healthcare is also tough because it is subject to what economists refer to as the Baumol effect. which is that a lot of healthcare workers, including doctors, are by definition supposed to be low productivity in the sense that a lot of us like high touch doctors. We like being able to have the doctor take their time with us, give us really good service, personalized service. You can't always accelerate that, which means that if it remains a lower productivity sector than other sectors, then wages are going to go higher because you have to incentivize people to go work in the sector to keep up with the wages in the higher productivity sectors, the non-healthcare sectors. So you're going to have to pay higher wages, and higher wages means higher costs for consumers. Higher wages for nurses and doctors means higher costs for consumers. So healthcare is tough for those two big reasons. But I also still think you're right. I still think that the introduction of miraculous new technologies, if we get them, can still make a big difference, even in spite of those barriers. I just think those barriers are big ones.
Yeah. But I feel like when I talk about AI causing job displacement, all sorts of problems, and people respond negatively, but then I say healthcare, they're like, oh, that'd be great. I'd love to see the cost of healthcare come down. I mean, I think you could probably save $500 billion, $1 trillion a year. 10-20% is totally realistic with AI. So much of the work and the information and the processing is very, very conducive to AI. It's very routine, repetitive, and the economics for AI are high. When you take it out of the theory and make it practical, people say, hells yeah, I want healthcare to come down because of AI. And okay, it displaces some people, but clearly it's a net benefit for society. So then all of a sudden, now people get why, oh, this is really good. And then, as you said, second, they get why the policy gets in the way, and you could have the worst of all worlds, which is AI plus inflation. This is my scenario planning where you have continue the trend, it gets better, it gets worse. And the worst is that the costs fall because AI makes things more efficient, but that doesn't mean that the falling costs will get passed through to the consumer. It doesn't mean prices fall because of the policy response. And the policy response is literally like people not liking AI and healthcare industry. It's easy for me to imagine healthcare industry saying, oh, we can't have AI because we got to protect the patients and only doctors can do this work. And they clog up the change to protect their job. And then you end up with AI saving a lot of money for the corporations that own the hospitals or the insurance companies, but doesn't actually drive lower costs to the consumer. So it's the worst of all worlds because of bad policy. It's kind of like what's happening with the dock workers, where you're not allowed to have driverless trucks or driverless cars because it's going to displace jobs. Preventing the technological change is like you get technological change anyways, but it ends up being really inefficient. And it's the worst of all worlds.
By the way, driverless vehicles, that's machine learning technology. So we're talking about basically the same thing here. And that's a great point, though, because we do have to get to the idea that there's going to be some societal and perhaps policy pushback on these changes. And that may have already started. And that really could slow the diffusion of these technologies. And there's something in particular that I'm worried about, which is that a lot of the jobs that at least are going to be perceived to be at risk and might end up being at risk are the jobs that are held now by very well-educated, influential types, people that went to all the fancy schools and they're friends with the politicians and they're friends with the corporate CEOs and whatnot. And they're the ones who might end up driving the pushback. And these are people that have a lot of power societally. They actually might succeed in elevating new barriers to the adoption of these technologies. So that is another potential outcome here, which is the technology evolves and it gets better and better, but the actual ability of the economy, of society to diffuse the technology, to start using it, might be slowed by these artificial barriers that have not yet been erected, but might if the politics goes far enough. And you're already seeing it, by the way. You're already seeing it. I think it was Bernie Sanders that just said he wanted to put some kind of a moratorium on the build out of data centers. I can't remember the exact details of the idea. But it's happening. It's starting and it might get places. And that will also be something that stops these technologies from widely spreading.
Not stop. The impact ends up being highly uneven. And so it ends up certain sectors or people are protected and certain sectors are not. I think that's very similar to the kinds of problems we have today and what causes a lot of populist rage and distrust of experts. So I'm worried that not that AI is not real and not going to have massive gains. I think those two things are near certainty. I'm worried that the policy, the political, the cultural response to AI is going to be so negative that we get more of the same of what's been happening with how let's talk about three scenarios: win-win, win-lose, lose-lose. So the win-lose we're talking about is what happened to blue-collar workers in automated factories, devastated towns, people in the blue cities didn't care, opioid addiction. All these things happened because of an uneven effect and because of politics and policy response was bad. I think another one that is not as clear, but similar, social media had a very uneven effect. And clearly, social media is a technological breakthrough. But I think our policy around it has been captive of the big tech, and we've had trouble really regulating it. And as a result, I think a lot of people are very angry about it, and it's affected people's view of big tech generally. So those are, to me, kind of examples of win-lose. Win-wins, as you said, are the internet, the initial internet in the 1990s, cloud technology, things where it's just mostly win-win.
Low unemployment, by the way, is a crucial part of this, and generally widespread prosperity, which I'm glad you brought up that example of what happened to a lot of blue-collar towns in the aftermath of the internet bubble and also in the aftermath of the trade shock with China. The thinking there and the best research shows that overall, these trends were good for the U.S. economy writ large. Unfortunately, the burden of adjustment fell disproportionately on a lot of specific towns, which did not recover the way that economists had expected them to. Those local labor markets didn't adapt. You had a ton of places that simply never got better, never got better. A lot of workers essentially were out of luck for a very long time unless they were willing to move. But then you're wrenching people away from their homes, and they did not have too much political and societal and economic power to respond. And the response in that case would not have been, I think, to say, no more technology, no more trade with the rest of the world. The correct response is, how do we help out these places that have lost out on this trend? How do we spread the prosperity? And we didn't. And by the way, there are also other historical examples of big productivity shocks, positive productivity shocks, where the effects were deeply uneven. Go back to the 19th century. This happened a lot, actually. It took a very long time after the onset of the Industrial Revolution itself before workers themselves were no longer falling behind the owners of capital. So that's definitely something to pay attention to. I think it's something that you're pointing to in your scenario where the corporate share goes way up or the labor share goes down. That is the thing to worry about, that there's a lot of people that are going to miss out on this, a lot of people who are going to really suffer if you let it continue for too long, which is why the policy response matters so much.
The fundamental technology that is AI is it turns capital into labor. So shifts power and economics from labor to capital, which is literally a token or a data center. And I don't think we have any idea what the policy response ought to be. And instead of spending all our time talking about whether or not it's a bubble or whether or not it's going to happen, I think we need to move beyond that question and move to like, okay, it's going to happen, or at least we better be prepared for it to happen.
Yeah, at least be prepared. I agree with that.
At least be prepared. I feel like whatever, our politicians are in their 80s, so they're going to be slow to see the future.
They won't be there forever.
Yeah, but so what? Because it's the parts, I think the problem with your point about this low unemployment is that with massive wealth inequality, with a strong stock market and people losing a job that they really love to go work at Walmart, these are not good social solutions, even if they're good economic solutions in theory. And I think our country doesn't have any ideas of what to do about this problem. And it's going to happen. The automation of manufacturing, everybody talks about it. You just mentioned it. We went from like 16 million manufacturing workers to 12 million manufacturing workers over like 20 years or something. It was a decline. I think there's 4 million less workers in the manufacturing industry over that long period from the China shock, automation. And I'm talking, because of AI, tens of millions of workers in a much shorter period. So this is what we need to figure out. And I just wish everybody would stop talking about how much money they're going to make or lose in the stock market on this and actually talk about the effect on hundreds of millions of American workers and globally. So that's what I wanted to make this episode about.
This is maybe for a future episode. Do you have a preferred suite of policies that you would want to push for to respond to a scenario like that if it turns out that way?
I think I have a spectrum of possible positives. I think one, US is way ahead of the world on AI. And I think I can imagine a world where the US is producing more AI workers than anybody and we're exporting them. So France and Germany and India and Brazil actually using American AI workers speaking their language. Export of American AI workers is a really interesting new phenomenon. And I also want to point out the fears that China produces hundreds of millions of AI workers and everybody uses China's AI workers.
To be clear for the audience, when you say AI workers, you mean literally non-human workers. You're not talking about human workers who work in the AI space. You're talking about workers who now exist as AIs. These are not human beings you're talking about.
Right. And I think in practice, it'll look a lot more like big tech, people using Uber or using Netflix. They use Netflix. They don't use Chinese Netflix. So it's an application that produces a job, like an AI lawyer. So I think America could end up being a huge exporter of AI, and that could be really positive for America. That's a positive. Another positive is that the number of workers per year in America is declining. More people are retiring. More baby boomers are retiring every year. I think approximately 5 million baby boomers retire a year. And we only add 2 to 3 million workers, young people entering the workforce every year. There's actually a labor shortage at the present. We're losing 1 to 2 million workers a year just on a pure flow of workers.
We're also cracking down on immigration, which does not help with this.
So maybe we need more workers. Maybe AI workers actually is not going to take away jobs. It's actually going to add. I think, as you said, people are afraid of it. I'm seeing it at the company. I do think that if you ask the machine, which is what we call ChatGPT and Claude, if you ask the machine what's going to happen, it says that actually doesn't cause a lot of unemployment. Unemployment goes up as a result of this phenomenon, but actually it suppresses new hiring. So instead of hiring 20 million people over the next decade, you maybe only hire 1 million. And so it's much more about suppressing new hiring than it is about unemployment and layoffs, which is what we're already seeing in the economy. I don't think it's totally related, but I think that what we're seeing in the economy today is what we're going to see as the new normal for the next 5-10 years.
I would definitely caution against assuming that what's happening in the economy right now is necessarily down to AI. I think a lot of that just has to do with basic economic cycle swings. We've seen the unemployment rate tick up over the course of the last year. We also just introduced a lot of shocks to the economy this year, the crackdown on immigration, the trade wars. These things are all intertwined and a little bit tough to disentangle. We're firmly in the realm of speculating into the near future, near to medium term future, rather than what's happening now.
But if AI causes us to not hire as much, then actually, I think the biggest impact will be on young people. The biggest impact of AI is that if you're me, I'm going to see lots of gains. But if you're my son and you're graduating from college, you're going to struggle because companies aren't hiring as much because AI does so much of the work. And so the easiest people to retrain are young people. So I think that there's an opportunity. If I'm talking to Sam Altman from OpenAI or Dario from Anthropic, I'm like, you guys should start AI schools. People should go to AI school because most companies are bad at adoption. They don't know how to do it. And they would hire somebody who could help them adopt AI. And I think I could see millions of people going to AI school and millions of those people getting hired and having a huge positive effect for the AI companies, for the society, for culture, for companies. And I think that that's the kind of way we turn this from a place of fear to a place of positivity.
Opportunity.
Opportunity, yes.
The point you're making there is that the tasks that matter to the economy may change, which is a very different story from mass disemployment. Suddenly, tons of people who can't get jobs, that kind of thing. If people can see it coming, then they can adapt for whatever new economic sectors might become more important and emerge out of this. And in terms of how to actually use the new technologies that are coming, start training in advance for those as well. How quickly an adjustment like that can happen is tough if people have been training to do something all their lives. If suddenly 70% of lawyers are unemployable, that's tough if you're in your third year of law school and you have a ton of student debt and you were hoping that a big corporate law job would help you pay it down and so forth. You're going to be in a tough place. But over time, that kind of adjustment can't happen where then you realize, okay, well, going to law school might be a bad idea, or law schools themselves end up teaching you something that's actually valuable. The amount of debt you're willing to take for it changes. People will get new information from which they can make new decisions about what they do. We have to be careful not to assume that everything stays fixed and it crashes up against this new reality. Adaptability is a big part of the way out of this mess if it does surface in that way.
But that's my positive take, is that unlike somebody who's in their 40s and they were coal mining their whole life, it's really hard to retrain that person. A white collar worker in their 20s is probably the most adaptive employee in the world. So I think that who gets impacted the most and who is the most willing to learn new skills, change industries, change jobs, drive the future. I think that could come together in a surprising win-win.
What about 40s age podcast?
Forget it. Forget
They're
it.
Toast. They're toast. I'll wait for the universal basic income and that'll be it.
Cardiff, this was fabulous. I don't know if you have any things to add to this.
I would say this. We've covered quite a spectrum here. And what I like about it is that if you position people who work in AI at one extreme end of the spectrum, I think a lot of them are even more extreme than you are. There are people who are like, this is going to lead to absolute economic catastrophe for the vast majority of workers who are going to be replaced. And we need to put in place some kind of a universal basic income to set them up. And then you take a lot of economists on the other end, where they very often use models that assume the technology is fixed and they're trying to go from there because they don't want to enter into the realm of trying to speculate on how the technology will change over time. So they maybe are underappreciating the dynamism in the sector, how it can change, how the technologies can get better. We've covered a lot of what's in between those two places. And maybe I'm a little bit closer to the let's wait and see. It may not be that bad. And you're closer to the this is going to be enormous. But we've covered the full suite of the spectrum. And I would just encourage everybody to just read as much as they can about this. Listen to this episode. But go seek out sources that you disagree with on this. I'm certainly compelled by a lot of what you said, Ben, to look for the more optimistic scenarios from the standpoint of the technology. But people who are really heady about it and think it's going to be enormous should also read some of the pessimistic takes that are out there and really try to inform themselves deeply. Because one way or the other, I think we will still be talking about this a lot over the next few years. I don't think that it's just going to go away. No matter what happens, there's no scenario where this doesn't become important. Either it becomes the thing that you just said, or it becomes a disappointment and we have other issues to deal with. So keep yourself informed on this so that at least you know what's going on. It is, I think, the most important thing to keep track of over the course of the next couple of years in the U.S. economy. Doesn't mean it's the only thing, but I would consider it to be the topic of the moment, maybe of the whole decade, is what we'll see.
Sorry, you triggered me at one thing, which is that if it's successful, it's deflationary. And if AI collapses, it's deflationary.
That's possibly right.
Because
not necessarily.
If the AI bubble collapses, it's the only thing driving growth in America today.
It's disinflationary, though, for number one, assuming no policy response that drives inflation back up, which I think we could expect to happen. But it's also disinflationary for two different reasons, and not all reasons for disinflation are good. There's the no demand in the economy, everybody's out of a job, nobody has money to spend, and therefore there's disinflation. And then there's the, oh my God, companies are getting so much better at creating an abundance of things that we can all enjoy that it's disinflationary. I think clearly, there's one world where that disinflation is better. But I do want to be clear, it doesn't mean we'll get disinflation. The policy response drives so much of this.
Just to sum it up, since we're gone longer than normal, yeah, the two extremes of it's doomsday or it's a normal thing like a cloud and it's just going to diffuse is I think it's not serving us. I think it's somewhere in the middle and trying to embrace it as an individual, being an adopter of it, using it, you can become an expert compared to everyone else pretty fast. And as a society, I think is if we adopt it, it's the future and it gives us so much opportunity for abundance. And I feel like generally people are scared of it or negative. It's not politically popular. And this constructive future is just not how people are talking about it or enough people are talking about it.
Well, for sure, this is a topic where people have very strong points of view. So if you disagree with anything said here, definitely yell at Ben about it.
Yes, all please right. Do. I'm going to disagree with you. So, all right, Cardiff, take us home.
All right. Thanks, Ben. This was fun. You have been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. I'm Cardiff Garcia of the Economic Innovation Group and host of the New Bazaar podcast. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Finally, for more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, please check out our show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.